Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We'll begin this hour by opening the phones for your opinions about the U.S. going to war or going to no-fly zone, if you prefer, in Libya. It's been 5 days now since the first Western planes went on their first raid to pen Gaddafi in and protect Libyan civilians. Opinions are all over the place. What is yours? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post it to our politics website. It's freecountry.org. This is our open forum, folks, our place in our democracy. There is no right or wrong opinion that you will be judged by, like on commercial talk stations. We are looking for diversity of opinion, and we really want to know what you think. So do you support this war? Do you support the U.S. role in it? Do you support how President Obama is handling it? And we'll talk to a White House correspondent in a couple of minutes. 212-433-WNYC. I don't even have to give out the number for this. Everybody's calling already, but it's 212-433-9692. We will bump you, by the way, if we happen with just 10 lines to get a lot of the same opinion coming in, because we want to have a conversation here. But as your calls are coming in, here is my super condensed ideologue's guide to positions on the Libyan war. Ready? The neocons, Paul Wolfowitz, William Kristol, Robert Kagan, people like that, they designed the Iraq war, and they are also for this. They say it's America's place to lead the world to democracy, including at times by military means if necessary. They say American leadership and power is essential, and they believe U.S. national security will ultimately be enhanced by establishing ourselves as the muscular force for freedom around the world. Now, the neocons are different from the conventional conservatives. They are only for war if they see a more immediate threat to the United States, as they did with Iraq. They denounced President Clinton's military deployments in the 90s as unnecessary liberal wars, Bosnia, Kosovo, Haiti, Somalia, which included Clinton and Bush the First. Then there are the liberal interventionists, led by Obama advisor Samantha Power, a former human rights and anti-genocide activist. They believe in the doctrine of the responsibility to protect. If a slaughter is underway, including by a government of its own people, it is the responsibility of the international community to intervene. National sovereignty is suspended, they say, when a dictator starts to massacre his own people. And then there are liberal opponents to the war, Denis Kucinich and others in the classic peace camp, who think there's just too much U.S. military might thrown around the world. And they were also skeptical of some of Clinton's deployments. And there are the libertarian isolationists, like Ron Paul. Limited government unless we're really under attack. No to Bosnia, no to Libya, no to Iraq. And I guess there are more, too. But there's my super condensed ideologue's guide to positions on the war in Libya. What's your opinion? What is your philosophical starting point? 212-433-9692. And of course, those are the purists, right? You could be forgiven for being confused or being ambivalent about this deployment yourself. So where are you at? Friend said to me yesterday, actually, let me bring in Glenn Thrush here, and I'll tell him this story and get some reaction as your calls are coming in. Glenn Thrush, White House correspondent for Politico. Hey, Glenn, welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian. Great to be back.
Friend said to me yesterday, I was so against the war in Iraq. I went to protest and everything. I can't believe I'm for this. You think there are a lot of folks out there like that?
I do think there are a lot of folks out there like that. I mean, this is a different sort of intervention. This is much more in the line of what Democrats have been calling upon for interventions really in the post-war era. I mean, there's a real precedent of sort of humanitarian interventionism on the part of progressive Democrats. So this really kind of cuts away at the at some of the it even attracts some of the people who are opposed to the Iraq War. I mean, when you got Paul Kagame, the current president of Rwanda, writing op-eds in support of this thing, you know, it's a different dynamic. But that said, I think the issue here in the Capitol is this process. I mean, nobody on the Hill was consulted prior to the president doing this. I think they were all under the impression that he was moving in the other direction. And I can tell you that the anger on the left from the Jerry Nadlers, Zoe Lofgren's, Sheila Jackson Lees of the world is pretty high at this point.
Right. And, well, what did you think of my brief ideologues guide? Did I get most of the camps right there? Did I leave anything out?
I think it was pretty good. Let me be perfectly honest with you. The topic that I would most like to be talking about today, though, is Carl Kruger. But I guess
a Brooklynite at heart.
Yes, you've probably. I think you've got that completely right. But I think the largest camp here, however, I would describe as the congressional opportunists camp,
uh-huh.
in which you had, I think, you had a lot of Hill Republicans in the past 3 weeks bashing the White House. Pretty intensely for moving really slowly. And when the president sort of outstripped them, even moving beyond a no-fly zone into this sort of fuzzy area of a no-drive zone, they've had to kind of switch their attacks and are now hitting him for having responded too late,
right.
Was that your
article on Politico about Newt Gingrich today?
No, but Gingrich has had more positions on this than the, you know, this is getting into
because he was first out bashing Obama for being too weak on Libya when he should be out doing something, blah, blah, blah. Now that the U.S. is going to war there, he's out saying this is none of our business and things like that.
Yeah, it's a political Kama Sutra, lots of positions here.
So, but more consistent than that is somebody like Paul Wolfowitz, hated by the left for being one of the intellectual architects of the Iraq War. And yet here was Paul Wolfowitz on ABC's This Week the other day. Oh, we don't have it. I thought we had Paul Wolfowitz. We'll get to Paul Wolfowitz.
I think it's time for you to break out your Paul Wolfowitz impersonation.
People wouldn't be happy. They'd never forgive me. In fact, Jason in Monticello, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling. Jason, are you there?
Yes, I am. How you doing?
Good. What's your position on this war? What do you think?
Well, I'm definitely totally against it. From what I can see from what's going on with the interaction with the American military into siding with the rebels, it seems to me more like a capitalist agenda.
Capitalist agenda?
Yeah. That's what it looks like. And it looks like, you know, as long as the revolutionary sweeps are going to continue to brew throughout the Middle East, that gives America an advantage to go ahead and step in and reshape these governments the way that they want it, put the people in there that they want, so they can always have their hands in the pot for the resources.
Who's going to make money on this?
Oh, definitely, definitely the U.S. Because in Libya, if I'm not mistaken, they have oil, right?
Yes, we don't buy much of their oil. We hardly get any oil from them. Europe gets a lot of oil from them.
Oh, well, it definitely would be a European benefit between British and the French or whoever else.
But you're following the money.
Yeah, I definitely believe. Yeah, territorial expansion.
Jason, thank you very much. Alfred in Putnam County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Alfred.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for accepting my call. You know, what I love about this country is that we can do this. You know, the last caller was saying that, you know, he's following the money, Republicans and Democrats. I still don't understand why we still have Republicans and Democrats. You know, the irony of the whole thing is, you know, here we are trying to promote democracy, but meanwhile, according to the Republicans, the Democrats don't exist.
So were you
I'm totally for this. As a matter of fact, I was praying for Obama to step up and show the character that he has.
Were you for the Iraq War?
Well, I was not for the Iraq War because as far as I understood, Saddam did not have the weapons of mass destruction because he used it on the Kurds. I thought the Iraq War, the same thing like the Kuwait thing, was strictly a Saudi Arabia. And I can't say the word or not. But anyway,
That's right. I gotcha on your difference between this and Iraq, and I appreciate it a lot. I'm going to go right to another caller, Michael in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi.
You support the war? What's your position? Michael, you there? You're on.
Yes, hello. I'm here.
Go ahead.
My position on the war is that I'm not sure and whether I'm for it or against it, and partly because I'm very disappointed that President Obama hasn't spoken to the nation about this. We've gone to war. He hasn't. The administration hasn't consulted Congress, and he hasn't said to the American people what we're doing. And I feel I'm a big fan of President Obama, but I feel really left in the lurch here that the country's gone to war, and no one has told us in any way that we can either agree with or disagree with or learn from why, what's happening, what the possible outcome might be. This isn't right. You've got to talk to Congress, and you've got to talk to the American people if you're going to go putting American lives at risk and attack government of another country.
Michael, thank you very much. And let's go on that point back to White House correspondent Glenn Thrush from Politico. Glenn, I'll bet a lot of people feel like that. Where was the prime time address by President Obama telling America that we are going to commit troops once again, and this is either a vital interest of the United States or a vital interest of humanity in general? Where was the president after his opposition to how President Bush steamrolled Congress, many Democrats would say, on the Iraq war? Where was the president really reaching out and either trying to build a congressional coalition for this or at least taking some kind of non-binding sense of the Congress resolution?
Well, I have to say, I mean, that's the big question. And as late as last night, senior administration officials were asked point blank about this. Will he give some sort of an Oval Office address, or will he even give something in the Rose Garden, a 5 or 6 minute explanation of why it is that he's chosen to do this? And the answer was no, which I have to say is quite surprising. I think the answer that the president wants to give on this is not one that explains the policy in the context of a larger doctrine or of larger goals, but in terms of expedience. The real reason we did this was to stop the pro-Qaddafi forces from taking over Benghazi. I mean, you can dress this up in any way that you'd like, but the imperative for moving ahead quickly was that Qaddafi was going to be able to consolidate his power in the entire country. And this was a Hail Mary pass to stop him from doing so. So in that regard, there isn't really that much of an explanation that the Obama administration can provide at this point in time, particularly with the chaos that's going on right now in terms of NATO. And the French and the Turks objecting to NATO taking over this from the United States. And make no mistake about it, the command and control of this, in addition to the majority of the sorties being flown, are U.S. planes. And it's sort of like we're in the position where we have rented a car and we want to drop it off, but there's nobody at the desk to take the keys of the contract. So we're sort of driving this thing around in the hopes that the French will rescue us.
You wrote on Politico today of the difficulty in succinctly describing the intellectual framework for Obama's approach to U.S. foreign policy. There are other Democrats out there making. I think John Kerry has been extremely eloquent on this, and he has placed this intervention, which he supports, in the context of the U.S. establishing a legitimate leadership role out there after Iraq and protecting our own national security, diminishing the possibility of more 9/11s by showing that the U.S. gets out there in support of democracy, puts lives on the line if necessary. I'm putting all kinds of words in his mouth here, but this is the philosophy that he's articulating, you know, and it would actually be very close to something that the neocons like Paul Wolfowitz would say, U.S. showing U.S. leadership, not only when it's to protect our tail in the short run, but this is going to show the world that the U.S. is the legitimate global leader. And, you know, if we don't stop Qaddafi from slaughtering his own people now, then it tells the whole rest of the Arab world that we will not back you up on this Arab Spring. So anytime a dictator shows some strength, you folks better back down. That's what's at stake. And that would be a global approach. And John Kerry is out there and saying it, but Obama isn't.
Well,
Obama actually did say something quite along those lines a couple of days ago in his press conference in El Salvador, and I'm really surprised that the White House hasn't sort of followed up, you know, because from these press conferences, talking points arise, and we have not seen them follow up on this. But he essentially said at this press conference that this was very much in our national interest, because having these peaceful rebellions turn into violent revolutions and civil wars and crackdowns is against the interests of the United States, because it will turn this hopeful generation of young people into violent revolutionaries and perhaps radical Islamists, which is, I think, a much more coherent way of putting it, and it dovetails as well with what Kerry said. But, you know, in doing this piece on defining an Obama doctrine, it was really interesting. I read over 50 articles with all these different definitions of what his doctrine was on foreign policy dating back from 2007. I think the most coherent strand in it, and you've heard it in the president's public pronouncements over the last week as well, is that we can do what we can do, and that we should not be taking on every single crisis in the world, that there needs to be sort of a pragmatic checklist for action. And his point is that that checklist was met for in a place like Libya, but not for Bahrain or Yemen.
Let's take some more calls. Listeners, where are you on this U.S. intervention in Libya? Roy in Kearney, you're on WNYC. Hi, Roy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, Brian.
Sure.
I'm very much, I guess you could say I'm sort of pro and con, because I look at it quite differently. As far as you mentioned the muscular force and the responsibility of us to protect, I was just wondering where that responsibility niche was when Darfur took place. And I think basically this is centered around some ethnic situations, but more so financially. You know, I look at how we went from agricultural to the industrial age, and now we're in the information age. And I like to view this information age as what I call technological colonization age, because the technology is such that we can't prop up anyone to represent us in these worlds, and where are the rest of the Muslim world on this issue? I would like to favor it if I seem where all of these so-called conservative or liberal Islamic countries has taken a position either they're for or against us going in there. I don't hear much about their involvement with this issue, only from a lip professing perspective.
Right. Well,
I want to see them with troops on the ground like us before we take the initiative to be the leaders of the world, because this is not the 19th century. We can't police the world no more, Brian, like we used to. And that's why I call it the technological colonization process that's taking place.
Roy, thank you so much. Frank in Fort Lee, you're on WNYC. Hi, Frank.
Hi, Frank. Hi. I'm calling to say that I totally disagree with the war in general. I think we have to take a very large picture of it, which is that the European interests should be taking care of what's going on in Libya, and not us. We do not have anything of interest there. It's a tribal country. It has not been settled as a full country, and we should not be there.
Frank, thank you. Steve in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello, good morning. I wanted to point out in a couple of aspects of this. One is that our Africa command is located in Germany, and if a part of Libya breaks off and needs our protection, then in locating the base there, we have a place for the Africa command. Hello?
Yes, I'm listening.
The other aspect of this...
You mean you want the U.S. to set up a military base in Libya?
I'm not saying that I want it. I'm saying that an aspect is that the Africa Command located in Germany mm-hmm. is right now irrelevant because we don't have a base in Africa. And I believe the America's motivation is that we want to have a base in Africa.
Steve, thank you. I'm going to leave it there. Rainey in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Rainey.
Hi.
For this?
I'm actually for the interfering of the United States, but I don't agree with the way that the whole thing happened.
Uh-huh.
See, I'm originally from Tunisia.
I live in Libya.
So we know Libya that it's like a tribe. So it's really, really sensitive situation. And now if the rebels win, Gaddafi, he belongs to certain tribes too. So later on, it's going to be, I hope not, but probably it's going to lead to a civil war. My opinion was actually, if the United States, from the beginning, will be interfering in a way to either arrest or assassinate Gaddafi, like completely, like
assassinate him rather than
right. I mean,
bomb everything else and destroy the nation's military and kill civilians by accident along the way. Just go get him.
Just go get him, and even could be secretly. Meanwhile, they work like to build kind of a government. Will be make sure that the government will be like representing the whole tribes in the country. And in that scenario, my opinion will be the best for the Libyan, the best for the United States. See, United States is not really popular. It's not even like familiar too much with North African countries.
Yes. Randy, can I ask, with your background in that region, what do you think would happen if Gaddafi were to suddenly be killed or arrested? Would what we see in Benghazi with the rebels become a pro-democracy movement like in Egypt, or would it break down into a tribal civil war with everybody just angling for power rather than a democratic country?
Okay. See, I think that it's very important for the new government that's going to happen in case, like you said, being killed or whatever, to clearly say that whoever used to follow Gaddafi will be forgiven, because we know that a lot of people, they belong to Gaddafi. We know a lot of people, they're very faithful to Gaddafi. So later on, if he get killed, they know they're going to get killed. So they're going to start fighting, and that's going to cause a civil war. So my opinion is really important to, yes, get rid of him, but meanwhile, to get a government that represents the whole country.
Rainey, thank you so much for your call. And Glenn Thrush, White House correspondent for Politico, to finish up, you know, Rainey's point about people needing to be concerned, the Gaddafi supporters kind of not knowing what's going to happen next. This is one of the main criticisms that I've heard of President Obama and the strategy here, especially from the right, which is that if the goal is not regime change, if the goal is protection of Benghazi or protection of civilians, but with the possibility of leaving Gaddafi in place, then you're actually going to discourage his military members from defecting, because they want to survive. So they're going to go with who's likely to be in power. And if they think he's going to be in power, then that emboldens him, that emboldens the military to stay on his side rather than turn against him, as may have happened elsewhere.
Well, the sense, though, in the White House is, and I don't know, none of us really can really predict where this thing is going to head.
Right.
But the sense in the White House is, you know, the optimum outcome here is that Gaddafi goes through peaceful or whatever other means, right? But they are less becoming by the day, less uncomfortable with the notion of there being a temporary partition, because they think these blockades, and particularly this financial noose, this seizing of, I think, in excess of $60 billion, that's with a B, $60 billion of overseas assets, by the way, undertaken by David Cohen, who used to be with the NYPD, who's now with the Treasury, will have a really significant impact. They think that if they corner him, and they're able to sort of bolster the rebels, that this is a long-term sustainable endgame. Of course, we saw similar strategies in Afghanistan, and we know how that turned out.
Listeners, thank you so much for chiming in with all your many opinions about the war in Libya so far. Obviously, we will keep this open forum going as we continue to cover the details of the war. And we thank Glenn Thrush, White House correspondent for Politico. Next time when we have you back, I promise we'll talk about Brooklyn politics.
Please.
Thanks a lot.
Take care. Singing freedom, freedom,
freedom, freedom. 2 weeks from tonight, Thursday night, April 7th, I'll be moderating another First Principles debate between Demos and the Ayn Rand Institute. The topic this time will be freedom. For whom and from what? For example, freedom from worry about getting health insurance versus freedom to not buy a policy. Ronald Reagan and Martin Luther King both invoked the word freedom, but in such different ways. Free tickets will be available in a few days, but for now we're collecting some input about freedom from you on our politics website, itsafreecountry.org. Send us your favorite quote about freedom, or post a freedom haiku. Again, share your favorite quote about freedom, or write a freedom haiku, you know, 17 syllables, 575, at itsafreecountry.org.